Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 25, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on intellectual disability, national origin, and the death penalty in the case of Hernandez v. Stevens. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I am the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts. The first is Aaron Blondel, who is an associate at the firm of Ellen & Winters. Our other expert is Professor Ernest Young, who is the Alston & Byrd Professor of Law at the Duke University School of Law. More complete bios of our speakers were provided you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. We're going to start off first with Aaron Blondel, who's going to give us a background of the case, and we'll go from there. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I just wanted to add my further disclaimer. I'm speaking in my personal capacity and not on behalf of Ellison Winters or its attorneys. This case is we filed an amicus brief in a death penalty cert petition. The court denied certiorari, we believe, because there were some arguments that some of these arguments were not preserved. But I'm going to talk about sort of the case background and the arguments that we made, and then I'm going to turn over to Professor Young. In this case, Mr. Hernandez was convicted of beating his employer to death and raping repeatedly his employer's wife. He was sentenced to death in Texas. The main fight in the trial court was whether he was exempt from the death penalty because he's mentally retarded under the Supreme Court decision of Atkins v. Virginia, which held that mentally retarded people cannot be put to death. As a further disclaimer, I'm going to use the phrase mentally retarded. The psychology community has recently revised that diagnosis. It no longer exists, and it's called intellectual disability. But because the Supreme Court used mentally retarded, I'm going to stick with that. So to take a step back and explain the mentally retarded dispute, the Atkins case basically said the states can decide whether somebody is mentally retarded and set their own standards for that. But it cited approvingly two clinical definitions that both essentially require courts to measure an individual's intellectual ability against a population. There's a three-part test. Only two of the parts are relevant. The first is intellectual functioning. Now, intellectual functioning is always, in the psychology community, defined by looking to somebody's IQ. Now, an IQ test is calculated by having you basically answer a bunch of questions and then plotting how you perform against a population norm. So there's an American taking an American IQ test is going to be normed against the American population. That's how your IQ is calculated. The other part of the mental retardation test is the adaptive functioning. And so the question there basically is, if you're 15 years old and you don't know how to tie your shoes, that may suggest that you have not adapted normally, which may suggest that you have an intellectual disability and may be mentally retarded. Now, the reason why people do cultural comparisons in that prong is that if you don't know how to tie your shoes at the age of 15, it also may be because you're from a culture that doesn't wear shoes with shoelaces. And so it's not a good thing to conclude that you're mentally retarded when the reason you don't know about that has nothing to do with your intellectual abilities and everything to do with your cultural background. The problem with both of those things is some defendants are minorities, come from different countries. And in Mr. Hernandez's case, he was born in Mexico, but had illegally immigrated into the United States and was living in the United States and committed his crime in the United States and was being tried in the United States. So what happened to him was during the trial court, the state had a psychology expert named Dr. Coons, and Dr. Coons essentially testified, well, if you're looking at his adaptive functioning, you need to look at his cultural group. And in fact, that is what Texas state law says, which is, again, borrowing from the definition of mental retardation the clinical definition of mental retardation that I talked about earlier. And I'm going to give you an example of Dr. Coons said a lot of things basically saying, well, yeah, his adaptive functioning is bad, but you have to look at it against his cultural group. So I think my favorite example is Mr. Hernandez's cultural group tends to have low socioeconomic status, low achievement, decreased social skills, increased substance abuse, and increased levels of criminal behavior. That is a quote from his affidavit in the trial court, and his testimony was very similar. So basically, the argument that the state put forward is, yes, he's got all of these, there's evidence that he adapts poorly to his environment, but you've got to put that in the context of his cultural group. He lost. The case ultimately went through direct appeals, federal habeas. Federal habeas was denied in the federal trial court, and then went up to the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit did another kind of, we think, potentially race-based measurement. The Fifth Circuit said, "Well, look at his IQ." Now, Mr. Hernandez received exactly one full-scale IQ test. It was performed in Spanish because that's his native language, and his English, as I understand, is not particularly good. Once he was administered the test, he was measured against an American population, and he scored a 62. The typical cutoff for mental retardation is a 70. Now, there's a 5-point measurement error. So down to a 65 can be considered not mentally retarded, but up to a 75 also could be mentally retarded. He scored a 62 under the American norm. But if he was normed against a Mexican population, he scored a 70. And what the Fifth Circuit said is, well, if you look at him against the Mexican population, he's actually at a 70, which is right at the top of that range. So we aren't very concerned about this score. So we think what that shows is that both the state's expert and the Fifth Circuit were saying you can't look at the evidence that he's mentally retarded, i.e. his IQ score and his adaptive functioning, against just Americans. You have to look against Mexicans or his cultural group or however you want to phrase it. What we discovered as we were researching this case, please forgive me, I have a cold, so I sound a little funny, is this is actually a widespread practice nationally. A lot of prosecutors seizing on the fact that the clinical definitions of mental retardation require measurement against a population are starting to argue that minority defendants need to be treated differently. There are some great examples. One state expert said IQ tests have historically been biased against minorities. If you have an African American who tests in the 70s, the clinician must be very cautious. There are also examples of prosecutors arguing that a Hispanic defendant should have his point bumped by 7.5 points because that's the measured error difference between how Hispanics perform on IQ tests versus how whites perform. Another state expert argued that an African-American defendant's score should be bumped by 3 to 6 points. So this is becoming a real problem nationally, and we have a number of cases where literally the appellate courts have affirmed a denial of a defendant's Atkins argument because, well, yeah, he scored a 79 on his IQ test, but he's African American, and so that's not going to be a real reflection of his intelligence. He's actually smarter than that score is suggesting, so we can go ahead and put him to death. Our argument in our amicus brief was that is clearly race-based decision-making. You are basically using a different yardstick to measure the intellectual abilities of minority defendants than you are to measure white defendants. And our argument was, under the Supreme Court's equal protection jurisprudence, especially its increasing adoption of the colorblind standard, that is just unconstitutional. And I'm going to turn it over to Professor Young at this point to delve into that.
Okay, well, thank you for having this call and having us on it. I think this is a really important issue for conservatives in particular. I don't ordinarily do a lot of work on behalf of capital defendants. In fact, the last time I did an amicus brief in a capital case coming out of Texas, it was on behalf of the state. But this case is about as good an illustration of why conservatives worry about race-based decision-making as I think I've ever seen. The debate about affirmative action laws has always included the point that, you know, sometimes, even though they're considered to be benign discrimination, and people argue that benign discrimination should be treated differently under the Equal Protection Clause, sometimes it's hard to tell whether something is actually benign or not. And so strict scrutiny in race cases is designed to smoke that out. The idea is that if it's really benign, it'll pass. There will be a really strong reason, a compelling interest, and the discrimination will be narrowly tailored to that interest. And often you have to reach a bit for examples where benign racial classifications actually turn out not to be so benign. So, for instance, in the college admissions context, admissions affirmative action turns out to help some races but actually hurt others, Asians in particular. But here, the danger in supposedly benign race-based thinking is just so darn clear. Here we have an argument that we have to take race into account that ordinarily helps racial minorities, right? The argument that intelligence tests and aptitude tests discriminate against racial minorities is usually made about the SAT and tests like that, and it's usually made in the context of an argument that those sorts of disparities should be taken into account in college admissions and settings of that nature. Maybe make it a little easier for racial minorities to get into college based on that. But here, we're taking the same notion and using it to make it easier to execute minorities. Sorry, Mr. Hernandez, you're still not getting into Harvard, but you're actually going to be executed now because we're going to take your race into account. There's just not even a whole lot to say about the constitutional validity of that practice. I mean, Hernandez is going to be executed in part because he's pretty smart for a Mexican. And I think that's just remarkable that any American government would follow that sort of policy. And look, obviously arguments about the use of race in governmental decision making have to be tailored to particular contexts. And there are other considerations that exist in hiring contexts and college admissions contexts. They may come out differently, but surely if there's anywhere we should be particularly wary of racial discrimination, it's when a man is on trial for his life. And so we wrote our brief with the idea that it was aimed directly at the conservatives on the court, at Chief Justice Roberts, at Justice Scalia, at Justice Thomas in particular. And we think it does, go exactly to what those justices have been saying about the dangers of even seemingly benign racial classifications. I can understand why the court didn't take this case. I mean, there's always a probability that any given cert petition is not going to be granted, and I think the state of Texas in their papers did a fairly good job of arguing that maybe there were some procedural problems with presenting the issue in this particular case. But I think it's an issue that the court is going to have to come back to and grapple with, because as Aaron said, this is not just Texas doing something funny in a death case. This is something that is happening all over the country in a lot of jurisdictions. And it's something that I think the court is going to have to address.
Excellent. Well, this is Christian Corrigan. If the both of you are ready, we've got a number of callers on the line. We can open it up to questions.
Sure.
That sounds great.
Well, for those of you on the call, we'll open the floor to your questions now. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. All right, looks like we've got our first question. We'll go right to.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. We seem to be struggling here with the junk science that was the basis for Atkins, because it is an unscientific leap from a score on an IQ test to lack of moral culpability in the sense of being criminally liable. I mean, I've had dogs that knew the difference between right and wrong and were morally culpable, even though their level of intelligence might not be as high as that of a human being. So if you're talking about whether to execute somebody for a crime, intelligence should not be the indicator. There are maybe other indicators of the inability to distinguish between right and wrong, but IQ is not it. Now, if you're going to have a standard at all using such a really poorly, very unreliable measure as IQ tests, which are really only valid for children, not for adults, it should be based on a single standard, and that should be of the United States. If there is some race of XYZ out there that doesn't meet our standards, then it doesn't meet our standards, and that's that. It should not be there should not be any adjustments for it one way or the other, certainly not on the basis of intelligence or IQ. So what do you see as the arguments that might get around this mistake made by Adkins?
So I don't want to take any position on whether Adkins was right or wrong. I have my doubts about it, but I haven't thought about that, you know, in the sort of depth that I'd want to take a strong position. Our brief assumed that Adkins was right, and then the question is, what do you do? But I think you're absolutely right in saying that the standard has to be the standard for all Americans, because we are, you know, holding these criminal defendants accountable for violating a standard that all Americans are held to, right? And so Adkins is necessarily saying that if you aren't intelligent enough to be held to that standard, then you can't be executed. So it seems just logically necessary that your intelligence would be measured against the same group that is being held to that standard, right? So, you know, if we're going to consider IQ and other forms of adaptation at all, we've got to use the same standards for that we're using for guilt in the first place, which is always going to be a standard that all Americans are held to at the same time.
I would add, setting aside for the moment whether Adkins was right in certain senses, I think you're exactly right to note that this is a hard thing to measure, and it's imperfect. It's even more imperfect when you graft something that was designed to be a clinical definition into a legal standard. It's not clear that psychologists know exactly how to diagnose this condition. Since Adkins has been decided, they actually threw out the concept of mental retardation. It's no longer a valid definition under the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Now the concept is intellectual disability, and the intellectual disability criteria actually de-emphasize IQ tests, probably for a number of the reasons you've suggested. But that just makes it harder on courts, right? Where are courts to go when the Supreme Court has adopted this clinical definition that doesn't even exist anymore? And I think you're also right that that the standards are, frankly, they're nebulous and they're hard, and they were designed for sort of clinical treatment and not for, you know, the hard and fast rules of, you know, the cut and dried, we're sentencing you to death or not, that the law needs to apply. And they do open the door to, I think our brief used was racial hokum. We found a case where an expert testified that any bias when the defendant was an Asian, that the court shouldn't worry about that person's IQ score, because any bias would favor Asians, because Asian Americans score higher than Caucasians on tests of cognitive ability. And she even added that Asians in general have larger brains than Caucasians. This is going on in American courts, and it's distressing. So I agree that the courts are going to be struggling going forward, I think, to apply Adkins given what the clinical standards offer.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again. While we're waiting to see if we have another question, which if you do, our lines are open. Press star and the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. I guess I'll pose a question. In a situation where, such as this, where using this type of analysis would save someone convicted of a crime from the death penalty, you know, what type of argument, you know, would be made as far as furthering a compelling state interest and being able to narrowly tailor this to only certain circumstances, you know, in order to – what type of – so for people who are going to make this argument that this, you know, that this might need to be done – if they're out there, other than you know, the court, you know, what's that argument typically going to look like?
So when you say when this sort of argument would save somebody from the death penalty, you mean if there was some situation in which taking race into account might make them less?
Exactly. Yeah. So
can you give an example of what you're thinking about? Because it's hard to come up with many. Isn't it? I mean, and I guess you could take into account the discrimination the defendant had suffered as a reason for his rage or something like that, but we don't allow that, generally speaking.
Yeah, so I was just sort of looking at the if you're using race and national origin and comparing it to population, let's say that it worked the other way, where the score went the other way, where it actually bump someone down into, or sorry, above into the range where it kept them from being executed. I guess that's what I'm looking at. If let's say there was a situation where you compared against the population that way, you know, is there any type of narrow scenario where you could see it being used that way? I guess that's my question.
I mean, I guess if people really push this argument about Asians that they, you know, that the tests tend to understate their or tend to overstate their intelligence, then you could say, well, sure, you know, this person's scoring at a 72, but really we ought to knock 4 points off because they're Asian. And I think that's unlikely. And so I think in a way this is going to be a one-way ratchet.
Sure.
And it's just going to make minorities more likely to be executed. And, you know, we have an awfully bad history in this country of executing minorities more readily because of certain assumptions we make based on their race. And we ought to be really wary of that. And it's kind of shocking that it's still going on.
To answer the second part of your question, which is what are the arguments that someone could offer to justify doing this, I'll take that since I think Ernie's less interested. I think the argument would be this. First of all, there is a lot of consensus that IQ tests, that minorities perform, some minority groups perform worse on IQ tests. So, you know, I think the argument would be, well, we shouldn't put our heads in the sand, right? We should actually, you know, that there's a lot of consensus in the scientific community on that. I think the other argument would be that so there's the IQ chunk and then the adaptive functioning prong, right? And for the adaptive functioning, the argument would be there are a lot of very common sense ways that you're considering someone's national origin. As I said, you know, because the whole notion of the adaptive functioning is to ask, if this person has not adapted normally to his or her environment, is that suggesting to us that the person has an intellectual disability? It's trying to kind of measure ability by looking at performance. And so it makes perfect sense to say, if this person can't use a fork at the age of 15, and these are the types of things that you look at, does that mean that the person just lacks the intellectual ability to conform to his or her environment? Or is the person from an area of the world where nobody uses forks? So there are, I think, very benign uses for that type of comparison. It's just drawing the line and preventing it from turning into bias. And I mean, that's, you know, our argument partially was that's what strict scrutiny is designed to do. It's to test exactly where that line is and whether the state has crossed it.
I just don't think you can really do that sort of analysis in a rigorous enough way to pass strict scrutiny. And I think that's a good thing, because it's so, as the testimony of Dr. Koons in this case made clear, it's just so easy for reasoning about someone's culture, their environment, you know, the way they adapt to culture, to shade over into racist stereotypes. It's very hard to control that sort of thing on a case-by-case basis, and I think we'd be much better off just ruling it out. I also think that since, you know, the underlying crime is a transgression against the norms of this society, right? So the fact that the, you know, evaluation of the intelligence might understate the person's ability to function in their own little enclave. I don't see how that's relevant when the ultimate question that Adkins is asking is this person able to function well enough in this broader society that we can hold them accountable when they breach this broader society's rules?
Great. Well, we've still got a number of callers on the line, but no questions. So again, this is the last call for questions. So if you have a question for either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. And just a quick note. I'll pose this question to you. Is your brief available online? For this case?
I think it is.
I believe it is. I'm going to look now. I will find the website. It should be on my firm's website, but let me double. If not, we will post it on my firm's website. And our website is www.elliswinchers.com. And my biography is on. I'll link it to my biography. If it's not there already.
Great. And then one thing we can do when we put this up as a podcast later, we can actually include a link to your website and to the document on the page for the podcast. So for anyone listening later on after this is posted, there should be a link to the brief there as well, and we'll do a link to the court's decision too. All right, looks like we do have one more caller. We can go ahead right with them now.
Hi, this is Scott Thompson. I apologize if this has already been asked. I know that there's a lot of psychometric research to the effect that an African American, for example, with an IQ of 70 is often higher functioning than a white person with an IQ of 70. And you know what that means, I don't know. But is that something that came up or was evaluated as part of the legal analysis of this case?
I think our concern is that it's not rigorously evaluated. So the purpose of strict scrutiny would be to guarantee that rigorous evaluation, right? To not just take the expert's word for it, but to really rigorously inquire into, you know, how solid is that research? How sure are we how it cashes out in individual cases? How solid is the link between the context in which that research is done and the particular context of culpability for criminal activity? You know, all sorts of, you know, questions that I think would need to be asked, because, you know, we're deciding who lives and dies in this context, right? And I think we need to be particularly sure before we, you know, go against the overwhelmingly solid norm, is you just can't take into account somebody's race in making that kind of decision.
To answer whether it was in the record in this case, it actually wasn't fought over in depth in this case, because frankly, 70 is the highest score within the mental reach. It's the cutoff for mental retardation, but it's technically considered within the mental retardation range. And even on the American norm on his full-scale IQ test, he tested a 70. And it wasn't until the Fifth Circuit that, you know, that was always considered evidence that he was mentally retarded, and then the Fifth Circuit pointed to it actually as evidence that he wasn't. So I don't think that was developed in the trial court simply because it was a surprise to everybody that the Fifth Circuit took the evidence the way it did.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, well, we'll do one more last call for questions. So you've got about 10 seconds. If you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key, star and the pound key. All right, well, it looks like we've exhausted all of our questions. Do either of our speakers want to take a minute just to give a or either one of you want to take a minute to give a final statement or sort of close things out here before we end the call?
Well, we just really appreciate your interest in this case and the opportunity to talk. I think this really is an important opportunity for, you know, conservatives to be principled about our stand on race. I mean, even if in this case it might help a capital defendant, I mean, who is unquestionably, you know, is guilty, is not contested, you know, that he committed the crime. but I think this is just such a vivid illustration of the dangers that lurk when you take race into account in governmental decision making, that it's an important issue, and I hope the court's going to come back and address it in a future case.
Well, fantastic. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts and thank you to our audience and for your questions. We always welcome feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Also take note that our now second annual Executive Branch Review Conference is coming up on May 7th, and you can find out more about that on our website at fedsoc.org. So until then, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.